them giggle, and after they carried me back, I realized with horror they had removed my rifle. I demanded to know where it was, and the tribesmen tried hard to explain they needed to take it away, loqué or no loqué, because if the Taliban ever did get into this room, they would not believe I was a wounded doctor, not with a sniper rifle like that. Loqué or no loqué. I lay there in the fading light when they finally left me entirely alone. I'd had water, and I'd eaten some of that flatbread they bake in the East. They had offered me a dish full of warm goat's milk into which I was supposed to dip it, but the combination was without doubt the worst-tasting sensation I'd ever had. I damn near threw up, and I asked them to take the milk away, telling them it was against my religion. I thus tackled that hard, awful bread bone dry. But I was grateful, and I tried to make that clear. Hell, I could have been dead up the mountain. But for them, I would have been. I'd been given a couple of blankets, and as the night drew in, I discovered why. The temperature plummeted from the searing heat of the day straight into the 30s. I noticed there was also an old iron wood stove in one corner of the room, where I later learned they baked bread every day. The system up here is for the two main houses, like this one, to do the bacon for everyone, and the bread is then distributed. I drifted into a half-sleep, my wounds still throbbing but thankfully not becoming infected. Hoo-yah, Sarawa. A kick to the door shattered the silence. I opened my eyes in time to see 8 armed Taliban fighters come barging into the room. The first one came straight over to my cot and slapped me across the face with all his force. That really pissed me off, and he was a very lucky boy that I could not move and was effectively a prisoner. If he'd even thought about putting his hands on me when I was fit, I'd have ripped his fucking head off, little prick. I knew they were Taliban because of their appearance. Very clean cut, manicured beards, clean teeth, hands and clothes. They were well-fed and could speak broken English. None of them was very big, maybe around 5'8" on average, and they all wore those old Soviet leather belts, the ones with the red star in the middle of the buckle. They wore Afghan clothes, but each one had a different colored vest. Every man carried a knife and a Russian pistol jammed into his belt. Everything made in Moscow, everything stolen. There was nothing I could get my hands on to defend myself. I had no rifle, no grenade, just my own personal badge of courage, the Lone Star of Texas on my arm and chest. I needed some of that courage because these bastards laid into me, kicking my left leg and punching my face and upper body, beating me to hell. I didn't give that much of a shit. I can suck this kind of crap up, like I've been trained. Anyway, they didn't have a decent punch among them. My main worry was that they might decide to shoot me or tie me up and march me off somewhere, maybe over the border to Pakistan, to film me and then cut off my head on camera. The guys at my bedside were demanded to know why I was there, what the American planes were doing, whether the United States was planning an attack on them, who was coming to rescue me. I kept telling them I was just a doctor, out here to help with our wounded. I also told them a huge lie, that I had diabetes. I was not a member of the Special Forces, and I needed water, which they ignored. The main trouble was, strangely, my beard, because they knew the U.S. Army did not permit beards. Only the U.S. Special Forces allows that. I managed to persuade them I needed to go outside, and they gave me this one single opportunity, one last desperate try to slip away. But I could not move fast enough, and they just dragged me back inside, threw me on the ground, and beat me even more seriously than they had before. Broke the bones in my wrist. That hurt, and I've since needed 2 operations to correct it. By now they had lit their lanterns, maybe 3 of them, and the room was quite light. And their inquisition went on for maybe 6 hours, yelling and beating, yelling and kicking. They told me my buddies were all dead, told me they'd already cut everyone's head off and that I was next. They said they'd shot down an American helicopter, killed everyone. They were just full of bravado, shouting, boasting they would in the end kill every American in their country and then some. We will kill you all! Death to the Satan! Death to the infidel! Then my interrogators found my rifle laser sight and my camera and wanted to take pictures of one another. I showed them how to use the laser to achieve their pictures, but I showed them the wrong way around and told them to stare into the beam with their naked eye. I guess the last favor I did them was to blind the whole fucking lot of them, because that beam would have burned their retinas right out. Sorry, guys. That's show business. Right after that, must have been around midnight, a new figure entered the room, a accompanied by two attendants. I knew this was the village elder, a small man with a beard, a man who commanded colossal respect. The Taliban immediately stood up and stepped aside as the old man walked to the spot where I was lying. He kneeled down and offered me water in a little silver cup, gave me bread, and then stood up and turned on the Taliban. I was not certain what he was saying, but I found out later he was forbidding them to take me away. There was no mistaking the authority in his voice. It was a small, quiet voice, calm, firm, and no one spoke while he spoke. They hardly said a word while this powerful little figure laid down the law, tribal law, I guess. When he left, he walked out into the night very upright, the kind of posture adopted by men who are unused to defiance. Upon the departure of the village elder, the Taliban suddenly decided to leave. Painful eyes, I hoped. Once more I was left, bleeding badly and very bruised, eternally grateful to the village elder, drifting off into a form of half-awake sleep, scared, really scared those bastards would somehow come back for me. Bang! Suddenly there went the door again. I nearly jumped out of my new Afghan nightshirt with fright. Were they back? With their execution gear? Could I get up and fight again for my life? But this time it was Sarwa, and I had to ask myself, who was he really? Had he tipped someone off? Was he in the clutches of the Taliban? I still had not been informed of the concept of Loke, possibly because they had no way to inform me, and anyway I had no choice but to trust them. Sarwa was carrying a small lantern, accompanied by a few of his friends. Three of the villagers lifted me off the floor and carried me to the door. I remember seeing their silhouettes on the mud walls, sinister, shadowy figures wearing turbans. Honestly, it was like something out of Arabian Nights, Big Marcus being hauled away by Ali Baba and his 40 thieves to meet the fucking genie. I could not, of course, know they were acting on direct orders of the village elder, who had told them to get me out of there in case the Taliban decided to ignore the ancient rules and take me by force. We traveled for a long way, the guys carrying me for more than an hour, maybe even two, and they walked tirelessly, like bushmen or Bedouins. We crossed a river and began to make our way up a steep gradient through the trees. Finally, we reached what I took to be a cave set deep into the mountainside. They lowered me to the ground. I did manage to make Sarwa understand I suffered from diabetes and required water at all times. I guess the dread of dying of thirst remained uppermost in my mind, and right then I knew I could not get down to that river, not by myself. They carried me to the back of the cave and set me down. I think it was around 0400 when we got there. It was Thursday, June 30th. They left me with no food, but they did come up with a water container, an aged Pepsi bottle, actually, the most evil-smelling piece of glass on this planet. I thought it must have been used for goat shit in a previous life, but it was all I had, a bottle from a sewer, but filled with water. I was afraid to put it to my lips, in case I contracted typhoid. Somehow I held it above my face and poured its contents into my mouth. I had no food or weapon, and Sarwa and his guys were on their way out. I was terrified they'd never come back, and had just made a decision to dump me. Sarwa told me he'd be back in 5 minutes, but I was not sure I could believe him. I just lay there on the rocky floor, in the dark, shivering in the cold. In the remains of that night, I fell to pieces. Finally lost my mind and sobbed hopelessly out of pure fear. Rena would have kicked my ass for sure and certain. I kept on thinking of Morgan, crazily trying to communicate with him, begging God to let him hear me. And soon it began to get light. Sarwa had been gone for over 2 hours. Jesus Christ, they dumped me out here to die. Morgan didn't know where I was or whether I was dead or alive, and my SEAL buddies had given me up for dead. Suddenly I was attacked by a tribe of big black Afghan ants. I might have given up, but I was fucked if I was going to be eaten alive by these little sons of bitches. I got myself raised up and laid into them with my Pepsi bottle. Most of them probably died from the smell, but I killed enough to beat them off for a while. And the hours ticked by. Nothing. No Pashtun tribesmen, no Sarwa, no Taliban. I was getting desperate. The ants were trickling back, and I no longer had the strength to mount a full assault on them. I went into selective killing mode, going for the leaders with my Pepsi bottle. I was just beginning to drift off again, maybe a little before 0800, when I could hear the little bells around the necks of the goddamn goats. When sand and rocks started raining down on me, I realized there was no roof to my cave. Half an hour later, Sarawa came, 5 hours after he said he would. He looked at my bullet wound and gave me more water. Then he posted a guard at the entrance to my roofless cave. The guard sat on a rock a little way above my entrance, his AK-47 slung over his shoulder. I kept drifting off, lying there on the floor, and every time I came awake, I leaned out to see if the guard was still there. His name was Norzamund, and he always smiled real friendly and gave me a wave. But we could not speak, no common words. He came down once to fill my water bottle, and I tried to get him to share his with me. No dice. I was alone in the late afternoon, and I saw the goat herds come by a couple of times. They never waved or made contact, but neither did they betray my position. Norzamund had left me some fresh bread, for which I was grateful. He went home shortly after dark, and for several hours I saw no one. I tried to stay calm and rational because it seemed Sarawa and his men were intent on saving me. I sat there by myself all through that long evening and into the night. I tried not to think of home and my mom and dad, tried not to give in to self-pity, but I wondered if anyone back home had the slightest clue about how much trouble I was in. There were now well over 200 people gathered at the ranch. No one went home. It was as if they were willing a hopeless situation to become hopeful, as if their prayers for me could somehow be answered, as if their presence could somehow protect me from death, as if they believed that if they just stayed in place, no one would announce I had been killed in action. Mom says she was witnessing a miracle. She and Dad were serving 3 meals a day to every person on that ranch, and she never knew where the food came from, but it kept coming. Big trucks from a couple of food distributors were arriving with steaks and chicken for everyone, maybe 200 meals at a time, no charge. Dad says the barbecues never went out. As June turned into July, many were beginning to lose faith and believe I was dead, except for Morgan, who would not believe it and kept saying he'd been in communication, mentally. I was hurt, but alive. Of that he was certain. Meanwhile, back in the cave, Norzamund came back with 2 other guys. It was about 0400 on Friday, July 1st, and they had no lantern. Once more they lifted me up and carried me down the hill to the river. We crossed the river and turned up the escarpment, back to the village. Finally we reached high ground, and I stretched out on the concrete. Sometime before dawn, Sarawa showed up with his medical bag and attended to my leg. He removed the blood-soaked dressings, washed out the wounds, and applied antiseptic cream and fresh bandages. Then, to my astonishment, he produced some insulin for the diabetes I didn't have. Guess I was a better liar than I thought, and I obviously had to take it. The stuff I do for my country. They moved me into a house up there near the top of the village, and soon after I arrived I met my first real friend, Muhammad Gularp, the 33-year-old son of the village elder and the resident police chief. Everyone called him Gularp, and his position in the community was very strong. He made it clear the Taliban were not going to take me while he had anything to do with it. He was an extremely nice guy, and we became good friends. We tried to communicate about families, and I understood he had a wife and 6 children, and God knows how many cousins and uncles. Conveying news about my identical twin brother was a tough one, so we just settled for brother. Gularp had a friend with him who was also a solid man, and they never left me alone. By this time I knew why. The village was entirely embarrassed when the Taliban had crept in here armed to the teeth and conducted an interrogation regardless of the wishes of the people. Those warriors had been on the verge of causing the ultimate retribution under the laws of Loke, which would have obliged the village to go to war to the last man on my behalf. I did not yet comprehend the full implications of Loke, but I knew it was important and that I would not be surrendered. And now I had a full-time guard detail in my room. This did not prevent other visitors from coming in, and my first on that morning in my new house was a little boy, maybe 8 or 9 years old. He sat on the edge of my cot and tried to teach me a Muslim prayer. La ilaha illallah, Muhammad ar Rasul Allah. I pretty soon got the hang of it and repeated it with him. He was thrilled, clapped his hands and laughed, and charged out through the door to round up a posse of other kids. Gularb tried to inform me that the repetition of that prayer meant that I was now a Muslim. And almost immediately, the first little boy came racing back into the room with all his buddies, about 20 of them, all eager to pray with the new Texan convert. At noon, the kids came back for prayers, bringing with them several adults, clearly eager to meet the new American convert, no longer an infidel. We prayed together to Allah, kneeling, painfully in my case, on the floor, after which we all shook hands, and I think they welcomed me to their prayers. Never told them, of course, I slipped in a quick one to my own God while I was at it, respectfully wondering if it was all right with him whether I could get my rifle back anytime soon. They all came back for afternoon prayers at 1700, and again at sunset. The little kids, my first friends, had to leave for bed right after that, but I remember they all came and hugged me before they left, and not having mastered goodbye or good night yet, they repeated their first American phrase again and again as they left the room.
Hello, Dr. Marcus.
Soon I received a visit from the village elder himself. He brought me bread, gave me fresh water, then sat down for maybe 3 hours while we discussed, as best we could, how I could get to an American base. It was clear I was a major problem to the village. Threats were already being received from the Taliban, informing the villagers how urgent it was for their cause that I be surrendered to them immediately. The old man imparted this to me but took the view I was in no shape to travel, and that it would simplify matters for a member of his Pashtun tribe to make the journey, on foot, to the big U.S. base at Assadabad, and inform them of my whereabouts. I had no clue at the time he was preparing to make the journey himself, some 30 to 40 miles alone in the mountains. He asked me to write out a letter for him to take to Assadabad. I wrote, "This man gave me shelter and food and must be helped at all costs." At one point during the evening, the tribal leaders came and had a meeting in my room, and they poured me several cups of that chai tea they drink and, I think, grow on a small scale up here. The ceremony included sweet candy, which you eat while you drink your tea, and that tasted great after my enforced diet of very, very dry baked flatbread. Gularb spent much of the evening trying to explain to me the complex threads that hold together the Pashtun tribes and Al-Qaeda, still working in conjunction with the Taliban army. The United States had been busy trying to clear all of them the hell out of Afghanistan for 4 years, but with only limited success. The jihadists seemed to have some kind of hammerlock on tribal loyalties, using a whole spectrum of mafia-style tactics, sometimes with gifts, sometimes with money, sometimes promising protection, sometimes with outright threats. The truth is, however, neither Al-Qaeda nor the Taliban could function without the cooperation of the Pashtun villages. And often deep within the communities, there are old family ties and young men who sympathize with the warlike mentality of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda chiefs. You can see these young potential Taliban recruits in any of the villages. I've seen dozens of them. Too young to have that much hate and murder in their eyes and hearts. Yet Sabre was obviously governed wisely by Gularb's father, and there was a sense of law and order and discipline in an essentially lawless land. I couldn't really tell, but I sensed something was making my guys jumpy, and about 10 or 11 o'clock that night, we moved. They had just brought me fresh water and bread, which I consumed gratefully, and then I was instructed to pack up and leave. By this time, my leg was a little better, even though it hurt, and with some assistance, I was able to walk. We made our way in the dark down to a different house and stepped off the trail directly onto the roof. We had some kind of a sheet, and the three of us laid down close together for warmth. I guess they felt there was some danger if I'd remained in my old spot. Maybe they had suspicion of someone in the village, worried that someone had tipped off the Taliban as to my precise whereabouts. Huddled with Gularb and his buddy, I was again amazed by the silence, that mountain silence. There was not one single sound in the entire village of Sabre, and for a Westerner, that's really hard to imagine. At dawn, we packed up and returned to the house. I wanted to sleep some more, but there was a big tree right outside the window, and in that tree lived the world's loudest rooster. That sucker could have awakened a graveyard. There were several times when if it had come to a straight coin toss between taking out Sharmak or the rooster, I could easily have spared Sharmak. By that Saturday morning, July 2nd, I was still in a lot of pain. My shoulder, back, and leg were often killing me. Gularb knew this, and he sent an old man from the village to see me. He came with a plastic pouch containing tobacco opium, which looks like green bread dough. He gave me the pouch, and I took a pinch of the stuff, put it in my lip, and waited. I'm here to tell you, that was a miracle. The pain slowly vanished completely. It was the first time I'd ever done drugs, and I loved it. That opium restored me, set me free. I felt better than I had since we all fell down the mountain. What with the Muslim prayers and now my becoming a devotee of the local dope, I was drifting into the life of an Afghan peasant. The old man left the bag with me, and it helped me get through the next hours more than I can say. For the first time, I understood the power of that drug, which is, of course, the one the Taliban and Al-Qaeda feed to suicide bombers before they obliterate themselves and everyone else within range. There's nothing heroic about suicide bombers. They're mostly just dumb, brainwashed kids stoned out of their minds. Outside the house, I could see the U.S. helicopters flying overhead. Black Hawk 60s and MH-47s, obviously looking for something. Hopefully me. I charged outside. I took off my shirt and waved it over my head, yelling, "Here I am, guys! I'm right here! It's me, Marcus! Right here, guys!" But they just flew off. All my hopes now rested in the soft tread of Gularb's father, the powerful yet tiny old man who was making his way on foot to Assadabad. Reports of my death greatly exaggerated. Gularb had now become the principal figure in my life. He called the security shots, made sure I had food and water, and was, in my mind, the link between us and his father as the old man toiled through the mountains to Assadabad. The Afghani policeman betrayed no sign of stress, but he did reveal to me that a letter had been received earlier from the commander of the Taliban forces. It was a written demand that the villagers of Sabre hand over the American immediately. The demand came from the rising officer of the Taliban army in the northeast, the firebrand Commodore Abdul, right-hand man to Sharmak, and a character who plainly saw himself as some kind of eastern Che Guevara. Gularb and his father had replied that it made no difference how bad the Taliban wanted the American, they were not going to get me. He spent some time trying to convey his personal position. They can't frighten me. My village is well-armed, and we have our own laws and rights. The Taliban need our support a lot more than we need theirs. He was a gallant and confident man. And he had not the slightest interest in a reward. Several times I offered to give him my watch in return for his unending decency to me, but he always refused to accept it. As for money, what use could that have been to him? There was nothing to spend it on, no shops, the nearest town miles and miles away, a journey that had to be made on foot. The door opened with a violent bang, and a group of adults and kids entered, all yelling the same thing. "Parachute! Parachute! Parachute! Dr. Marcus, come quick!" I made my way outside, aching to high heaven all the way. I resolved to have another shot of that opium soon as I returned. What could we see? Nothing. Whatever had landed was down, and I stood there trying to make them understand I needed to know if there had been a man on the end of that parachute, and if so, how many parachutes there had been. Was this a drop zone for my buddies to come right in and get me? But the tribesmen simply could not understand me. The kids who I detected were the ones who had actually spotted the parachute, or parachutes, were just as mystified. There was a sudden conference, and most of the adults upped and left. I went back in. They returned maybe 15 minutes later and brought with them all my gear, which they had hidden away from the eyes of the Taliban. They gave me back my rifle and ammunition, my H-gear, that's my harness, and in its pocket the PRC-148 inner squad radio, the one for which I'd lost the little microphone earpiece. It still had its weakish battery and its still operational emergency beacon. I was aware that if I grabbed the bull by the horns and went right outside and let rip with this communications gear, I would once more be a living, breathing distress signal, which the Americans might catch from a cruising helo. On the other hand, the Taliban, hidden all around in the hills, could scarcely miss me. I found this a bit of a dilemma. But the rearmament guys of Sabre also brought me my laser and the disposable camera. I grabbed my rifle and held it like you might caress a returning lover. This was the weapon God had granted me, and so far as I could tell, still wanted me to have. We'd traveled a long way together. Outside, I put on my harness, locked and loaded the rifle, and prepared for whatever the hell might await us. But with my harness back, I was not yet done with the kids. That harness contained my notebook, and we had access to the village ballpoint pen. I marched them back into the house and carefully drew two parachutes on the page. I drew a man swinging down from the first one. On the second one, I drew a box. I showed both pictures to the kids and asked them, which one? And about 20 little fingers shot forward, all aimed directly at the parachute with the box. Beautiful. I had intel. There had been some kind of supply drop. And since the local tribesmen do not use either aircraft or parachutes, those supplies had to be American. They also had to be aimed at the remnants of my team. Everyone else was dead. I was that remnant. I asked the kids exactly where the chutes had dropped, and they just pointed to the mountain. Then they raced out there. Had my buddy somehow found me? Had the old man reached Asadabad? Either way, it was one hell of a coincidence the Americans had made a supply drop a few hundred yards from where I was taking cover. The mountains were endless, and I could have been anywhere. 1 hour later, bang! That goddamn door went off again like a bomb. In came the kids, accompanied by a group of adults. They carried with them a white document, which must have looked like a snowball in a coal mine up there where the word litter simply does not exist. I took it from them and realized it was an instruction pamphlet for a cell phone. Where the hell did you get this? I asked them.
Right out there, Dr. Marcus, right out there.
Everyone was pointing at the mountainside. Parachute? I asked.
Yes, Dr. Marcus, yes, parachute.
I sent them right out there again, trying to make it clear that I needed the mountainside search for anything like this, anything that might have come in on the parachutes. My guys don't drop cell phone pamphlets, but they might have been trying to drop me a cell phone and the pamphlet just came with it. Gularb stayed, but the others went with the kids, like a golf crowd fanned out to look for Tiger's ball in deep rough. Gularb and I settled down. We had a cup of tea and some of those delicious little candies, then lounged back on our big cushions. Suddenly, bang! The door nearly cannoned off its hinges. I shot tea all over the rug, and in came everyone again. This time they had found a 5590 radio battery and an MRE, meal ready to eat. The guys must have thought I was starving. Correct. But the battery did not fit my PRC-148 radio, which sucked, because if it had, I could have fired up a permanent distress signal straight into the sky above the village. As things were, I had no idea if my present weak radio beacon would reach much higher than the rooftops. I had no need to interrogate the kids further. If there had been anything else out there on the mountain, they'd have found it. There obviously wasn't. Whatever the drop had contained, the Taliban had beaten the kids to it. But then I noticed something which made my blood boil. Almost every one of the kids had been battered. They had bruises on their faces, cut lips, and bloody noses. Those little pricks out there had beaten up my kids, punched them in their faces to stop them getting the stuff from the drop. There's no end to the lengths these people will go to win this war. And I'll never forget what they did to the kids of Sabre. I spent the rest of the day patching them up. All those brave little guys trying not to cry. I nearly wiped out the entire contents of Sarawa's medical bag. More strategically, it did seem the American military believed there was at least one SEAL still alive down here. The question was, what now? No one wanted to risk sending in another MH-47 helicopter, since the Taliban seemed to have become very adroit at knocking them down. But I was desperate to give the Americans some kind of a guide. I rigged up my radio emergency beacon to transmit through the open window. I had no idea how much battery I had left, so I just turned it on, aimed it high, and left it there on the window ledge, hopefully pinpointing my whereabouts to any overhead flights by the Air Force or the Night Stalkers. To my surprise, U.S. reaction happened a whole lot quicker than I thought it would. That afternoon, the U.S. Air Force came thundering in, dropping 1,200-pound bombs on the mountainside beyond the village, right where the Taliban had picked up the stuff from the parachute drop. The blasts were incredible. Rocks and dust cascaded into the room. One of the walls sustained a major structural fault as blast after blast shook the mountain from top to bottom. Outside, people were screaming as the bombs hit and exploded. Thatched roofs were blown off. There was a dust storm outside. Mothers and kids were rushing for cover. The tribesmen were at a complete loss. Everyone had heard of American air power, but they had not seen it firsthand like this. In fact, none of the bombs, I guess by design, hit Sabre, but they came close. Damned close. All around the perimeter. The villagers tried to clean up the mess, rebuild walls and roofs, and calm down frightened kids. I looked out at the havoc around me, which happened all because of me, and felt the most terrible sadness. And Gularb understood what I was feeling. He came over and put his arm around me and said, "Ah, Dr. Marcus, Taliban very bad. We know. We fight." It seemed apparent that my presence here was causing a more and more threatening attitude from the Taliban, and the last thing I wanted was to cause pain and unhappiness among these people who'd sheltered me. But my options were narrow, despite the Americans being, it seemed, hot on my trail. The Taliban were probably not overwhelmingly thrilled at being bombed by the U.S. Air Force, and had probably sustained many casualties out there on the mountain. It occurred to both Gularb and me that the word revenge might not be far from the curled lips of these hate-filled Muslim fanatics. Gularb had a wife, children, and many relatives to think about. In the end, the decision made itself. Clearly, I had to leave, just to keep the village from becoming a battleground. The question was, where should I go? Gularb and I resolved that I should walk with him and two others over the mountain to the U.S. outpost in the Pashtun village of Monagi. The plan was to wait until long after dark and then slip out into the high pastures around 11 o'clock, stealthily passing right under the noses of the probably sleeping Taliban watchmen. I could only hope my left leg would stand up to the journey. I'd lost a ton of weight, but I was still a very big guy to be half-carried by a couple of slender Afghan tribesmen, most of whom were 5'8" and 110 pounds soaked to the skin. Night fell. Quite abruptly as it does up here in the peaks when the sun finally slips behind them. We lit no lanterns, offering no clue to the Taliban. We just sat there in the dark, sipping tea and waiting for the right moment to leave. Suddenly, from right out of the blue, there was the most colossal thunderstorm. The rain came swiftly, lashing rain, driving sideways over the mountain. It belted down on the village of Sabre. All windows and doors were slammed tight shut because this was monsoon rain driving in right across the country from the southwest. No one would have set foot outside home because that wind and rain would have swept anyone away, straight off the mountain. Up above us, the mountaintops were lit up by great bolts of forked lightning, ice blue in color, jagged electric neon in the sky. Thunder rolled across the Hindu Kush. But slowly I became used to the storm, and fell into a deep sleep flat out on the floor. Our departure time of 2300 came and went, and still the rain lashed down. Midnight came, and with it a new calendar date, Sunday, July 3rd, which this year would be the midpoint of the 4th of July weekend, a time for celebration all over the USA, at least in most parts, except for those in profound mourning for the lost special forces. I slept right through the night, and woke up in broad daylight after the rain. I checked my watch and rounded on Gularb. I was supposed to be in Monagi, for Christ's sakes. Why the hell hadn't he made sure I was? What kind of guide was he allowing me to oversleep? Gularb was sanguine, and since we were growing very efficient at communicating, he was able to tell me he knew it was the first time I'd been able to sleep for a long time, and he thought it would be better to leave me. Anyway, he said we could not possibly have gone out in that weather because it was too dangerous. The overnight walk to Monagi had been out of the question. One way and another, I took all this pretty badly. I actually stormed out of the house, racked by yet another disappointment. I left my rifle behind and walked slowly down the steep hill to take a pee. At the conclusion of this operation, I took myself up the hill a little way and sat down on the drying grass. The fact was, my leg was still a problem, and I was a living, breathing target as well as a distress signal. There sat the mighty Sharmak with his second-in-command, Commodore Abdul, and a large trained army, all of them with essentially nothing else to do except kill me. I stared around the hills, but I could see no one outside the village. Suddenly, Gularb raced down the hill toward me. He pulled me down the trail leading to the lower reaches of the village. He was running and trying to make me keep up with him, and he kept shouting, signaling again and again, "Taliban! Taliban are here! In the village! Run, Dr. Marcus! For God's sake, run!" He pushed his right shoulder up under my left arm to bear some of my fast, dwindling weight, and I half hobbled, half ran, half fell down the hill. Of course, by my own recent standards, this was like a stroll on the beach. I suddenly realized we might have to fight, and I'd left my rifle back in the house. I had my ammunition in the harness, but nothing to fire it with. And now it was my turn to yell, "Gularb! Gularb, stop! Stop! I don't have my gun!" He replied something I took to be Afghan for, "What a complete fucking idiot you've turned out to be." But whatever had put the fear of God into him was still right there, and he had no intention of stopping until he'd located a refuge for us. We ducked and dived through the lower village trails until he found the house he was looking for. Gularb kicked the door open, rammed it shut behind him, and helped me down onto the floor. And there I sat, unarmed, largely useless, and highly apprehensive about what might happen. Gularb, without a word, opened the front door and took off at high speed. He went past the window like a rocket, running hard up the gradient, possibly going for the Hindu Kush all-comers 100 meters record. God knows where he was going, but he'd gone. 3 minutes later, he kicked open the door and came charging back into the house. He was carrying my rifle as well as his own AK-47. I had 75 rounds left. I think he had more in his own ammunition belt. Gravely, he handed me the Mark 12 sniper rifle and said simply, "Taliban, Dr. Marcus, we fight." He looked more serious than I'd ever seen him. Not afraid, just full of determination. Up on that mountain when he'd first seen me, Sarwa had made the decision with his buddies that I, a wounded American, should be granted Loke. The doctor knew perfectly well from the first moment by that gushing mountain river that the situation might ultimately come to this, even if I didn't. It was a decision that, right from the start, had affected everyone in the village. I think most people had accepted it, and it had obviously been endorsed by the village elder. I'd seen a few angry faces full of hatred, but they were not in the majority. And now the village chief of law and order, Mohammed Gularb, was prepared to stand by that unspoken vow his people had given to me. He was doing it not for personal gain, but out of a sense of honor that reached back down the generations, 2,000 years of Pashtun Wala tradition. "You will defend your guest to the death." I watched Gularb carefully as he rammed a new magazine into his AK. This was a man preparing to step right up to the plate. And I saw that light of goodness in his dark eyes, the way you always do when someone is making a brave and selfless action. We had two areas to cover, the door and the window. I explained it was up to Gularb to cover the entrance. Gularb nodded fiercely. "Okay, Marcus," he said. And it did not escape me, he'd dropped the doctor part. I tried to tell him to stay calm and shoot straight, nothing hysterical. That way we'd win, or, at worst, cause a disorderly Taliban retreat. And then we both heard the opening bursts of gunfire high up in the village. There was a lot of it. Too much. The sheer volume of fire was ridiculous, unless the Taliban were planning to wipe out the entire population of Sabre. And I knew they would not consider that, because such a slaughter would surely end all support from these tribal villages up here in the mountains. The Taliban and their Al-Qaeda cohorts were mercilessly cruel, but this Ben Sharmak was not stupid. Besides, I detected no battlefield rhythm to the gunfire. It was not being conducted with the short, sharp bursts of trained men going for a target. It came in prolonged volleys, and I listened carefully. There was no obvious return of fire, and right then I knew what was happening. These lunatics had come rolling out of the trees into the village, firing randomly into the air and aiming at nothing, the way they often do, all jumping up and down and shouting, "Death to the infidel!" Stupid pricks. Their loose objective is always to frighten the life out of people, and right now they seem to be succeeding. I could hear women screaming, children crying, but no return of fire from the tribesmen of Sabre. I looked at Gularb. He was braced for action, leaning in the window with me, one eye on the front door. We both clicked our safety catches open. Up above, we could still hear the screaming, but the gunfire subsided. Little sons of bitches were probably beating up the kids. We waited for maybe 45 minutes, and then it was quiet. I left it to Gularb to call this one.
Taliban gone, he said simply.
What happens now, I asked him.
Bagram?
Gularb shook his head.
Bagram, he said.
Then he signaled for the umpteenth time,
helicopter will come.
I rolled my eyes heavenward. I'd heard this helicopter crap before, and I had news for Gularb.
Helicopter?
No come, I told him.
Helicopter come, he replied.
As ever, I could not really know what Gularb knew or how he had discovered what was happening, but right now he believed the Taliban had gone into the house where I'd been staying and found I was missing. No one had betrayed me, and they had not dared to conduct a house-to-house search for fear of further alienating the people, and, in particular, the village elder. Armies need food, cover, and cooperation, and the Taliban could only indulge in so much bullying before these powerful village leaders decided they preferred the company of the Americans. Gularb was certain they had gone, but he was equally certain we could not dare go back to the house. It was almost 10 in the morning by now, and Gularb was preparing to leave and take me with him, once more out into the mountains. Clutching our rifles, we left our little mud and rock redoubt in the lower street and headed farther down the mountain. Painfully, I made the 200 yards to a flat field, which had been cultivated and recently harvested. It was strictly dirt now, but raked dirt, as if ready for a new crop. About the size of 2 American football fields, it was an ideal landing spot for a helicopter. For a few moments, I considered writing a large SOS in the dirt, but Gularb was anxious, and he half-carried, half-manhandled me out of the field and back onto the lush mountain slopes, and there he found me a resting place at the side of the trail where I could take cover under a bush. And this carried a bonus because the bush contained a full crop of blackberries. And I lay down there in the shade luxuriously eating the berries, which were not quite ripe but tasted damned good to me. It was very quiet again now, and my trained sniper's ear, honed perhaps better than ever before, detected no unusual sound in the undergrowth. Not a snapped twig, not an unusual rustling in the grass, no unusual shadow behind a tree, nothing. We waited there for a short while before Gularb stood up and walked a little way, then turned and whispered, "We go now." I don't know why it happened, but something told me to look up, and I cast my eyes to the slope behind us. And right there, sitting very quietly, his gaze steady upon me and betraying nothing, was Sharmak, the Taliban leader, the man I had come to capture or kill. I'd seen only a grainy, not very good photograph of him, but it was enough for me. I was certain it was him. And I think he knew I knew. He was a lean character, like all of them, 40-ish, with a long, black, red-flecked beard. He wore black Afghan garb, a reddish vest, and a black turban. I seem to recall he had green eyes, and they were filled with a hatred which would have melted a U.S. Army tank. He stared right through me and spoke not one word. I noticed he was unarmed, and I tightened my grip on the Mark 12 and very slowly turned it on him until the barrel was aimed right between his eyes. He was not afraid. He never flinched, never moved, and I had a powerful instinct to shoot that bastard dead right here on the mountain. After all, it was what I had come for. That or capture him, and that last part wasn't going to happen. Sharmak was surrounded by his army. If I'd shot him, I would not have lasted 20 seconds. His guys would have gunned down both me and Gularb, and then, minus their beloved commander-in-chief, probably would have massacred the entire village, including the kids. I considered that and rejected shooting him. I also considered that Sharmak was clearly not about to shoot me. The presence of Gularb made it a complete standoff, and Sharmak was not about to call in his guys to shoot the oldest son of Sabre's village elder. Equally, I did not feel especially inclined to commit suicide. Everyone held their fire. Sharmak just sat there, and then Gularb nodded to the Taliban boss, who I noticed made an infinitesimal incline of his head, like a pitcher acknowledging a catcher's signal. And then Gularb walked slowly across to talk to him, and Sharmak stood up, and they turned their backs on me and moved farther up the mountainside, out of my sight. There was only one subject they could possibly be discussing. would the people of Sabre now agree to give me up? And I could not know how far Gularb and his father would still go to defend me.
228! It's 228!
They were gone for 5 minutes, and they came back together. Ben Sharmack stood for a few moments staring at me, and then he climbed away, back to his army. Gularb walked down the hill to me and tried to explain Sharmack had handed him a note that said, "Either you hand over the American, or every member of your family will be killed." Gularb made a dismissive gesture, and we both turned and watched the Taliban leader walking away through the trees. And the village cop offered me his hand, helped me to my feet, and once more led me through the forest, half-lifting me down the gradients, always considerate of my shattered left leg, until we reached a dried-up riverbed. And there we rested. We watched for Taliban sharpshooters, but no one came. All around us in the trees, their AKs ready, were familiar faces from Sabre ready to defend us. We waited for at least 45 minutes, and then amid the unholy silence of the mountain, two more guys from my village arrived. It was obvious they were signaling for us to leave, right now. Each of them gave me support under my arms and led me up through the trees on the side of this steep escarpment. I have to admit I no longer knew what was going on, where we were going, or what I was supposed to be doing. I realized we could not go back to the village, and I really did not like the tone of that note Gularb had shoved in his pocket. I made the top step first, and as I did so, I came face to face with an armed Afghani fighter I had not seen before. He carried an AK-47, held in the ready-to-fire position, and when he saw me, he raised it. I looked at his hat, and there was a badge containing the words which almost stopped my heart. Bush for President. He was Afghan Special Forces, and I was seized by panic because I was dressed in the clothes of an Afghan tribesman, identical to those of the Taliban. But right behind him, bursting through the undergrowth, came two U.S. Army Rangers, in combat uniform, rifles raised, the leader a big black guy. Behind me, with unbelievable presence of mind, Gularb was roaring out my butt-ass class numbers he'd seen on my trident voodoo tattoo.
228! It's 228!
The Ranger's face suddenly lit up with a gigantic smile. He took one look at my 6-foot-5-inch frame and snapped, "American?" I just had time to nod before he let out a yell that ripped across the mountainside.
"It's Marcus, guys! We got him! We got him!"
And the Ranger came running toward me and grabbed me in his arms, and I could smell his sweat and his combat gear and his rifle, the smells of home, the smells I live with, American smells. I tried to keep steady, not break down, mostly because SEALs would never show weakness in front of a Ranger. "Hey, bro," I said. "It's good to see you." I asked the Ranger captain how many guys he had, and he replied, "We're good. 20. In my view, that was probably a bit light, since Sharmack could easily be back to his full strength of maybe 150 to 200 warriors, reinforced by Al-Qaeda. "We got gunships, Apache 64s, standing by," he said. "Whatever we need, we're good." Before we left, I asked them how the hell they'd found me, and it turned out to be my emergency beacon in the window of the little rock house in the mountain. The flat crews had picked it up when they were flying over and then tracked it back to the village. They were pretty certain the owner of that PRC-148 radio was one of the original SEAL team, but had to consider the fact it might have been stolen by the Taliban. They did not, however, think it had been operated by Afghan tribesmen in this instance, and they thought it unlikely the beacon had been switched on and aimed skyward by guys who had not the slightest idea what it was for. They thus reasoned that one of the SEALs was right down there in that village, or in any event pretty damned close. So the guys just closed in on me, somehow moving their own dragnet right past the Taliban dragnet. And suddenly there I was, dressed up like Osama bin Laden's second in command, arms wrapped around a couple of tribesmen like we were three drunks falling up the hill. Led by Gularb, we set off for the village and moved back into my second house, the one where we'd sat out the storm. The army threw a security perimeter all the way around Sabre, and they carried me up past that big tree and into the main room. The guys rustled up some tea, and we settled down for a detailed debriefing. It was noon in Sabre, and in attendance was a very serious group of army personnel, from captains on down, mostly Rangers and Green Berets. So far, no one had found the bodies of Mikey, Danny, and Axe, and we spent a long time going over satellite photographs for me to pinpoint the precise places they had died. I recounted how Axe had held our left flank with such overwhelming gallantry, and how Danny's shot so many times kept firing, trying to hold our right flank until his dying breath, and how in the end, there were just too many of them, with too much firepower, too many of those big Russian-made grenades, the ones that finally blew Axe and me clean out of the battle. Taliban casualties had been, of course, high. I think all of us in that little room, including Gularb, thought the Taliban would not risk another frontal assault on the Americans. And so we waited until the sun began to slip behind the mountains, and I said goodbye to all the kids, several of whom were crying. Sarawa just slipped quietly away. I never saw him again. Gularb led us down to the flat field at the base of the village, and with the comms up and running, we waited it out. The Ranger security guard was in formation around the perimeter, in case the Taliban decided to give it one last shot. I knew they were out there, and I never took my eyes off that mountain slope as we all sat there, around 20 army personnel and maybe 10 villagers, the guys who had stuck by me from the beginning. Way over the high horizon, shortly before 2200, we could hear the unmistakable distant beat of a big U.S. military helicopter clattering in over the mountains. We saw it circling, far away from the slopes where I believed the main Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces were camped. And then suddenly Gularb grabbed my arm, hissing, "Marcus! Marcus! Taliban!" I stared up at the escarpment, and there in the darkness I could see white lights moving quickly across the face of the mountain. "Taliban, Marcus! Taliban!" I could tell Gularb was really uneasy, and I called over the army captain and pointed out the danger. The army comms guys moved into action, calling in the United States Air Armada we knew was out there, fighter bombers and helicopters, ready to attack that mountain if there was even a suggestion the Taliban might try to hit the incoming rescue helo. I considered it was obvious that they were planning one last offensive, one last-ditch attempt to kill me. We could still see the rescue helo way out in the distance when the U.S. Armed Forces, who'd plainly had it up to their eyeballs with this fucking Ben Sharmack, finally let it rip. They came howling across those pitch-black crevasses and blasted the living hell out of those slopes. Bombs, rockets, everything they had. It was a storm of murderous explosive. No one could have lived out there. The lights went out for the Taliban that night. All those little white beams, their fires and lanterns, everything went out. These guys had chased me, tortured me, pursued me, tried to kill me about 400 times, blown me up, nearly kidnapped me, threatened to execute me. And now my guys were sticking it right to them. Beautiful. I saw a report confirming 32 Taliban and Al-Qaeda died out there that night. Not enough. The helo came in slowly and put down a few yards from us. The loadmaster leaped to the ground and opened the main door. The guys helped me into the cabin, and Gularb joined me. Instantly we took off, and neither of us looked out at the blackness of the unlit village of Sabre. Me, because I knew we could not see a thing. Gularb, because he was uncertain when he would pass this way again. The Taliban threats to both himself and his family were very much more serious than he had ever admitted. He was afraid of the helicopter and clung to my arm throughout the short journey to Assadabad, and there we both disembarked. I was going on to Bagram, but for the moment Gularb was to stay on this base, out there in his own country, and assist the U.S. military in any way he could. I hugged him goodbye, this rather inscrutable tribesman who had risked his life for me. He seemed to expect nothing in return, and I had one more shot at giving him my watch. But he refused, as he had done four times in the past. Our goodbye was painful for me, because I had no words in his language to express my thanks. I'll never know, but perhaps he too would have said something to me if he'd only had the words. It might even have been warm or affectionate, like, "Noisy bastard, footsteps like an elephant, ungrateful son of a gun," or, "What's the matter with our best goat's milk, asshole?" But there was nothing that could be said. I was going home. And he may never be able to go home. Our paths, which had crossed so suddenly and so powerfully in a life-changing encounter for both of us, were about to diverge. I'd lost 37 pounds. My face was scoured from the crash down Mountain One. My broken nose needed proper setting. I was racked with pain from my leg. My smashed wrist hurt like hell, and so did my back, as it will when you've cracked 3 vertebrae. I'd lost God knows how many pints of blood. I was white as a ghost, and I could hardly walk. A nurse who knew me cried out, "Oh, Marcus," and turned away, sobbing. I declined a stretcher and leaned on the doctor, ignoring the pain. But he knew. "Come on, buddy," he said. "Let's get you on the stretcher." But again, I shook my head. I'd had a shot of morphine, and I tried to stand unassisted. I turned to the doc and looked him in the eye, and I told him, "I walked on here, and I'm walking off, by myself. I'm hurt, but I'm still a SEAL, and they haven't finished me. I'm walking." The doctor just shook his head. He'd met a lot of guys like me before, and he knew it wouldn't do a damn bit of good arguing. I guess he understood the only thought I had in my mind was what kind of SEAL would it make me if they had to help me off the plane. No, sir, I won't agree to that. And so I entered my home base once more, moving very slowly down the ramp under my own steam until I touched the ground. By this time, I noticed 2 other nurses were in tears, and I remember thinking, "Thank Christ Mom can't see me yet." Right about then, I think I caved in. The doctors and nurses ran forward to help me and get me stretchered into a van and directly to a hospital bed. The time for personal heroics had passed. I'd sucked up every goddamn thing this fucking country could throw at me. I'd been through another hell week to the 10th power, and now I was saved. The moment I was secured in Bagram, they made news of my rescue available. I had been in the hands of the U.S. military for some hours, but I know the Navy did not want anyone to start celebrating until I was well and truly safe. The call went around the world like a guided missile. Bagram, Bahrain, SATCOM to SPECWARCOM, Coronado, direct phone link to the ranch. In Texas, Chief Guthrow walked my mom to the phone and informed her that whatever the call was about, she had to face it. A voice came down the line and demanded, "Chief, is the family assembled?" "Yes, sir." "Mr. and Mrs. Luttrell?" "Yes," whispered Mom. "We got him, ma'am. We got Marcus, and he's stable." Mom started to collapse right there on the bedroom floor. Scotty moved swiftly to save her from hitting it. Lieutenant J.J. Jones bolted for the door, stood on the porch, and called for quiet. Then he shouted, "They got him, guys! Marcus has been rescued!" They tell me the roar which erupted over those lonely pastures, way down there in the backcountry of East Texas, could have been heard in Houston, 55 miles away. Morgan says it wasn't just your average roar. It was spontaneous, deafening. Everyone together, top of their lungs, a pure outpouring of relief and joy for Mom and Dad and my family. It signaled the conclusion of a 5-day vigil in which a zillion prayers had been offered by God-fearing folk. They understood in that split second after the announcement that those prayers had been asked and answered. For them, it was a confirmation of faith, of the unbreakable hope and belief of the SEAL Chaplain Trey Vaughn and all the others. Immediately they raised the flag, and the stars and stripes fluttered in the hot breeze. And then the SEALs linked arms with my family and my friends and my neighbors, people who they might never see again but to whom they were now irrevocably joined for all the days of their lives. Because no one, according to Mom, could ever forget that one brief moment they shared, that long-awaited moment of release when fears and dreads were laid to rest. I was alive. I guess that's all it took. And all these amazing guys with hearts as wide as the Texas prairies burst suddenly into song. God bless America, land that I love. On my 3rd day in the hospital, the bodies of Mikey and Danny were brought down from the mountains. They were unable to find Axe. I was told this, and later that day I dressed, just in shirt and jeans, for the drive out to the ramp ceremony, one of the most sacred SEAL traditions, in which we say a formal goodbye to a lost brother. The C-130 was parked on the runway, ramp down. There were around 200 military personnel in attendance when the Humvees arrived bearing the 2 coffins, each draped with the American flag. And all of them snapped to attention instantly, no commands, as the SEALs stepped forward to claim their brothers. Very slowly, with immense dignity, they lifted the coffins high, and then carried the bodies of Mikey and Danny the 50 yards to the ramp of the aircraft. As they carried Mikey to the plane,